On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Thomas Williams about John Duns Scotus. So we cover topics like just who is Scotus? What did he think? So what were his thoughts on voluntarism, on univocity, on simplicity? How did he really relate to those like Thomas Aquinas or others in the medieval period? And much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon Askew.
And we're a podcast that hopes to develop habits of thinking that are centered around particular virtues of charity, curiosity, cheerful confessionalism, and critical thinking. And today, I am really stoked to introduce you all to Dr. Thomas Williams, who I think is going to help us think about the medieval period. We've had a couple of episodes recently on various aspects of medieval theology, and I think, at least in my corner of what is broadly considered evangelicalism, I think Thomas Aquinas has seen somewhat of a renaissance, but there have been others that seem to not be getting the publicity that I think they should. And one of those is John Duns Scotus. So I texted my friend Ross Inman and said, who do you think are the premier experts on Duns Scotus? And he said, Richard Cross and Thomas Williams. And we just had an episode with Richard Cross recently. And I was like, well, then we've got to get Thomas Williams. And here he is, so kind to join us to talk about Scotus and all the fun things that go with that. So I'm really looking forward to this. Dr. Williams, for those who aren't familiar with you, give us a little bit of background about who you are, and then tell us, what is it that got you interested in studying and writing and thinking about Scotus?
Well, first of all, it's good to know that I'm in such august company. That's a nice thing to hear. I work in medieval Latin philosophy. I did my PhD at Notre Dame in 1994. With a dissertation on Scotus, and I have published on Scotus, on Anselm a fair bit, did a translation of Scotus's Ethics, a recent translation of Augustine's Confessions, which I'm very proud of as well. So I work a lot in sort of ethics, philosophy of religion kind of topics, and also theories of the atonement. So that's what I've mostly focused on. As far as how I got interested in Scotus, it was, I think maybe a lot of us in medieval have a story of getting nudged in a providential direction by Eleanor Stump. And in my case, I was sort of fishing around for a dissertation topic. I've never been good at coming up with topics. And she said, well, you know, a lot of people have done work on this topic, but they haven't really looked at Scotus. Why don't you do that? Okay, well, Eleanor has never steered me wrong. So I did, and it ended up being fascinating, and Scotus took over my life for a few years. And yeah, that's how it happened.
Cool. Well, I guess we can jump right in. Why don't we start with just who Scotus is, maybe some biographical information, anything that you think the listeners would be interested in learning about his life, and then we'll kind of walk through some of his thinking after that.
We don't know nearly as much about Scotus's life as we do about some of the other medieval thinkers, but we do know a little bit. He was born in the town of Duns, which, so that's both his family name and a place name. Which is just over from the English border, it's maybe 10 miles into Scotland, and was given to the Franciscans pretty early, educated in, you know, with the Franciscans in the north of England, then went to Oxford, where he studied and then taught, and became very prominent in the Franciscan order, and as often happens, sort of moved around a little bit. As one of the budding stars, so ends up at the University of Paris sometime in the late 1290s, where that was the theology department in Europe at the time. So everybody who was anybody at all had to be at Paris for a while. So he studied further at Paris, then lectured there. Late in his life, was transferred to the Franciscan school in Cologne, where he died in 1308. So it's a short life. As a result of which he left a lot of his material in various stages of editing. So he was still working on revising a lot of his works, and that project was left unfinished. So his text came down to us in a kind of disorderly fashion. And when I was in graduate school, the critical edition hadn't proceeded very far. We're in much better shape now. We've got better editions. We know more about the layers of revision and so forth. And I think now the greatest difficulty is getting that material out to people who are not going to be reading it in the Latin.
Yeah, I imagine I'd love to learn Latin, but it would be awesome to have it all in English.
And even, I mean, Latinists will tell you, Scotus's Latin is terrible. It's like he didn't, I hear him, this is terrible. I hear him with a Groundskeeper Willie accent from The Simpsons. I'm sure that has no relationship to reality, but his Latin, it's like he just was not paying attention in Latin class. And so he makes up words and it's really terrible. Nobody really likes translating Scotus. Nobody even likes reading him in Latin. I've published a fair bit of translations of Scotus. I really need to do more. I may really be the only living person right now who actually positively enjoys getting Scotus into English. And I should probably do it as a service to the church. I don't know. Y'all are going to bring me under conviction of the Holy Spirit. Just asking me about these things.
Well, there's a couple. I think there's three big aspects of Scotus that I'm most interested in, and those three are voluntarism, univocity, and simplicity. I think the one I want to start picking your brain on is univocity. You've got a paper. Oh, what's the title? What univocity? The doctrine of univocity is true, or something along those lines. And I was in a PhD seminar with Greg Welty. And I tried to basically argue for a doctrine of analogy. And I use your paper as kind of I'm arguing against this. But I think I've come around to your position on this. So all that to say, can you sketch out a little bit about what is doctrine of analogy? What is univocity? And why is it, do you think, Scotus is helpful or useful in saying potentially univocity is actually the proper way to think about language and language about God?
Sure, there's so much to unpack there. The title of the paper is one of my favorite paper titles because philosophy paper titles are usually boring. And so it's the doctrine of univocity is true and salutary. And the salutary part is because there's been, on the part of a number of theologians, this polemic against univocity as being not only false, but really damaging to the faith and to the way we think about God. So unpack a little bit of that. The doctrine of univocity is just the view that the language that we use about God is all of a piece with the language that we use about creatures. So that at least at some level of analysis, when I say, for example, standard example, Socrates is wise, and I say God is wise, there's got to be some sense of wise in which I can apply that word both to God and to a creature with no change of meaning. It applies sort of without remainder, unproblematically to both. And I argue in that paper, as you know, that that we need that view because the alternative is, I think, complete unintelligibility. So that we simply do not know what we're saying when we say of God that God is good or that God is just or that God is wise and so forth. Now, the doctrine of analogy is particularly associated with Thomas Aquinas. So this is an Aquinas versus Scotus issue that continues to be played out. And the fans of analogy tend to be Thomas and people who want to retrieve Aquinas. It's a doctrine that's very often poorly expressed. So people will say things like, well, as Aquinas teaches us, all of our language about God is metaphorical. Absolutely not. That is not Aquinas's view. A metaphorical language about God, it would be something like a mighty fortress is our God, or the Lord is my rock and my salvation. Well, the salvation part, that's literal. The rock part, obviously we know that God is not, is he sedimentary or igneous? We understand that that's a metaphor. But language like God is good, God is just, those are not metaphors, Aquinas says. They are literal predications. But there's some slippage in the meaning or the concept or the application of the term because of the radical difference between God and any creature. So that God's wisdom and creaturely wisdom have to be irreducibly distinct. And so how you work that out is going to depend on, you know, your particular metaphysics and your particular slant. But for Aquinas, I always find the way of teaching that works best with my students is it's like if I were to show you a photograph of one of my nieces, and I hold up the photograph and I say, "This is my niece." Well, what enables me to, what makes sense of that claim, or what makes it true when I say this is my niece? Well, there's a resemblance relationship, right? The picture is, in a way that turns out to be really hard to define and clarify, like my niece, right? It's of my niece. But obviously the picture and my actual physical, literal niece are not the same thing. And what I mean when I say this is my niece, when I point to the photograph, and what I mean when I say this is my niece, when I point to the girl, the young lady now, they're related, but different. And for Aquinas, it's the resemblance relationship between God and creatures that allows us to have literal but still analogical predication. My argument in that paper is that analogy either collapses into univocity at some level, or we simply don't know what we're saying when we say about God, that God is good or just or what have you. And I'm glad to hear that I might have convinced you. It's always, I don't go into my, for example, into my classes, my undergraduate classes, especially trying to convince anyone of anything. And I sell analogy really hard when I teach Aquinas. And then I can't wait to get to SCOTUS and sell univocity really hard and see if there are any converts. And there often are, which is very gratifying.
Like you said, it seems to collapse into univocity at some point. And I think that was the thing that I kept running into, was I was collapsing to needing some univocal core of meaning to have any, I guess, intelligible meaning whatsoever. It seemed that it was the way that I was trying to do analogy needed univocity to make sense of it. So...
And my suspicion is, my argument in that paper is that that's going to be true, sort of no matter how you do it. If you think about it in my kind of silly photograph case, so obviously my niece has two different but related meanings in those two predications, but there's a univocal core, right? The univocal core is, well, you can rewrite the one statement as this is a photograph of my niece. And then both statements are literally true. My niece has the same meaning in both. And it's only because you have that univocal core that you can do the analogical predication as a kind of shorthand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So why do you think it is that so many are almost hell-bent on denying univocity as a way to understand God and to speak of God? It seems that people want to say, if you want to have any version of classical theism whatsoever, you have to reject univocity and you have to have analogy. Is it just... they're equivocating on terminology and they don't really understand what's going on, or what's going on there?
Historically, I think that that's just clearly wrong. I mean, SCOTUS is a classical theist. He holds to univocity. I've argued that Anselm holds to univocity, even though he says a couple of things he shouldn't. You can actually make a case, and some Thomists are receptive to this, that the dispute here is purely verbal, or at least that you can get univocity out of SCOTUS's kind of univocity out of Aquinas's kind of analogy, as it were. But I think the big resistance is that people think it collapses the distinction between God and creatures, that the God of classical theism is supposed to be wholly other, utterly distinct from creatures. There is no categorization or species or what have you into which both God and creatures fall. And so how can there be terms or concepts that apply without remainder equally to both? And there are two things I want to say to that, one of which I'm very certain about, and the other which, well, honestly, I'm very certain about that too, but I haven't had the guts yet to put it into print. So the one that I have said in print that I can certainly stand behind is univocity is about thought and language. It's not about ontology or metaphysics. So SCOTUS absolutely agrees that there is no, so to speak, ontological basket into which you can put both God and creatures. Absolutely agrees with that. He just thinks that language can, and indeed must apply to both in the same way. In part because, I mean, where do we get our capacity to use language, and where do we get the meanings for our terms? Well, from our experience of creatures. So if language and thought derived from creatures don't apply to God, well, that's all the language and thought we have, which means we can't think about God or speak about God. And that is, I mean, that is disastrous. Some people don't find that disastrous. There's a lot of apophaticism about in theology. I'm just deathly allergic to apophaticism in any form. And that may be part of the reason I'm so enthusiastic about SCOTUS. Here's the part that I'm sure about, but that I haven't said in print, but I have said at conferences and, you know, on Facebook and stuff, which is, I don't see how you can really go all in on the view that God is wholly other and maintain that God has fully and without remainder entered human history in the person of Jesus Christ. I just don't see how you can maintain the incarnation in light of this view that God is wholly other. The incarnation is sort of by definition impossible on that view. But we start as Christians, you talk about cheerful confessionalism. I'll go to a theologian of my own, well, we're not exactly confessional, my own church. So I'm an Episcopal priest as well. One of the great incarnational theologians of my communion, Phillips Brooks, who is Bishop of Massachusetts, best known for having written the Christmas carol, O Little Town of Bethlehem, expresses, I mean, even in that hymn, how silently the wondrous gift is given. It's not, sort of metaphysically speaking, this unbelievable catastrophe. It's God slips into the world he made as if the incarnate, you'd almost expect it, that God and humanity are brought so near that it's just the quiet entry of God into the world he made as those he made in his image. So there's my cheerful confessionalism about the incarnation in talking about SCOTUS and univocity.
So you have another paper, Reason, Morality, and Voluntarism in Duns Scotus, A Pseudo-Problem Dissolved. So maybe for the listeners who don't know what voluntarism is, define that, tell us whether SCOTUS was one, and if there's a problem with that, how does he get around that perceived problem?
So voluntarism kind of comes in different versions, and the kind of baseline version of voluntarism, so from the Latin word for will, voluntas, the baseline version is, to maybe oversimplify it beyond recognition, a voluntarist is somebody who is, so to speak, heart forward rather than head forward. So someone who emphasizes the heart, the will, affect, emotion, more than or in preference to or before emphasizing intellect, thought, and so forth. So Augustine is classically a voluntarist in that sense, that his emphasis on the heart and of the will as the center of human identity and of relationship with God, even of the virtues as being different forms of love. That in itself is a kind of voluntarism and would be recognized as such. That's a pretty broad kind of voluntarism. Then you get, beginning, you know, especially in the late 13th century, which is where I spend a lot of my time, especially with Franciscans, beginning with sort of the earliest Franciscan thinkers and accelerating, what people would call psychological voluntarism. Psychological voluntarism is a number of theses about the relationship between the will and the intellect. So the idea that the ultimate determinant of human behavior is what we choose rather than what we believe, what we will rather than what the intellect dictates. That's a view that psychological voluntarists hold. Typically, they will hold that the will remains free to act against the intellect's final judgment, so that you can come to the conclusion, X would be the best thing for me to do, but, you know, darn it, I'm going to do Y. And for a lot of Franciscans, and maybe, well, come clean about this, for me, it seems perfectly obvious that happens all the time, right? The good that I would, I do not. The evil that I would not, that I do. I know better. But my will can be turned away, can turn away from even my best judgments. So that's psychological voluntarism. There's no question that SCOTUS is a psychological voluntarist. That's not contentious at all. Is that a bad thing to be? I don't think so. I think it's an obviously true thing to be. But in contemporary discussions about free will, psychological voluntarists are basically a kind of libertarian in the contemporary sense. And libertarianism, of course, has its problems. One of its problems is that it seems to leave choice or will too much untethered from human nature and from human belief, so that choices become at bottom irrational or inexplicable. Now, I actually think that's just right. I think that a genuinely free choice is at bottom explainable only by the fact that that's what the creature decided, the human being or the angel. Again, that seems right to me, but it's a very contentious point. So there's no contention about interpreting SCOTUS, but there's contention about whether he's onto something good or something bad. Here's where the contentiousness about even interpreting SCOTUS comes in. I think he was also a further kind of voluntarist, namely a theological voluntarist. And the theological voluntarism in this sense is basically the idea that morality, or at least some substantial chunk of morality, is determined by the divine will, and that the divine will is not in turn determined by anything else. So that given human nature as God creates it, given God's own character, given all of those facts, it is up to God whether certain things are commanded or prohibited, encouraged or discouraged, what have you. There is a lot of debate about whether SCOTUS held that view. Basically, I'm the one who says he does. And I get a lot of pushback. And sort of made my early career by being super obnoxious about how everybody who had written on this was totally wrong. And, you know, I alone have lived to tell it, so to speak. There's some repentance that had to happen, right? Not about the views. The view is absolutely right, I still think. But I was not overly charitable sometimes in expressing it. Why would people resist it? Well, because it's a crazy view. The view is bonkers. And I think people... Look, you never want one of your favorite philosophers to turn out to have a crazy view. And surely it is a crazy view that if God had commanded us not to kill, except like every other Thursday, you get a free shot, right? Then that would be the rule. That can't be right, right? That just can't be right. There are various ways of mitigating the, as it were, bonkersness of this. But here, to me, they all run aground on the fact that every time SCOTUS has a chance to mitigate his views, he passes it up. And he's committed to, you know, things like in what Christians tend to call the sacrifice of Isaac, but Jews much more sensibly call it the binding of Isaac, right? That it was right. It was morally right because God made it morally right for Abraham to do what he did. And if he had not called it off, it would have been morally right for Abraham to go through with it. And how is that? Well, because there's nothing, SCOTUS says this explicitly. I'm not ventriloquizing him here. He's really saying it. There's nothing about Abraham, and there's nothing about God, and there's nothing about killing, and there's nothing about human happiness. There's nothing of any of the available constraints that you would expect that makes that, as it were, fundamentally impermissible. There has been some argument, well, but given human nature, there's a sort of default to the moral law as we know it. But I think even there, it's hard to make that case. Why are we required to love our parents, but not required to, or to honor our parents, but not required to honor our cousins? Well, because God issued the one commandment and didn't issue the other. Now, the one thing God can't do, basically, is change the fact that God is infinitely worthy of love himself. So God can't change the truth value of God is to be loved. And from God is to be loved flow other truths like God is not to be shown dishonor or irreverence. So thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. We get that one for free, right? God can't God can't make it permissible to show irreverence to him, because he can't make himself anything other than the highest good and the most and indeed infinitely worthy of respect and reverence. Can't do that. But kind of everything that doesn't have directly to do with God, according to a theological voluntarist, according to Scotus, if I'm right about him, that's at the divine discretion.
That's interesting. I want to spend a good chunk of time on divine simplicity. I would have follow-ups on voluntarism, but I think that's, you gave a great summary. So I want to transition to simplicity. Scotus has a little bit different view than somebody like Thomas Aquinas on what divine simplicity means. He seems to allow for, if I understand right, what's called a formal distinction. So a lot of, I guess, contemporary thinkers don't like the formal distinction, whether they think it's a legitimate category or whether they think it's violating divine simplicity. So could you give just a little bit of a summary initially on what it is that Scotus thinks and how it differs? And then we can talk about whether it's a viable option for simplicity after that.
Sure. I mean, here's perhaps the weakest part of the questions and answer that I was preparing myself for, because I do have, you probably know, a co-authored paper on divine simplicity, but it was my co-author who did all the heavy lifting on that paper. And I wrote one section that has to do more with my my determination to make, you know, to show that Scotus is a theological voluntarist, and he did all the hard stuff. So it might be helpful to back up a little bit and talk about why classical theism is committed to simplicity in the first place and what it is, and then we can talk about the formal distinction.
Yeah, that's good.
That's all right. So divine simplicity is simply the doctrine that God has no parts of any kind. And everybody sort of agrees that, I mean, obviously God doesn't have a body, leaving aside the incarnation, right? He does now. People worry nowadays about whether you can make sense of God's being outside of time, but certainly the tradition is very clear that God has no temporal parts in addition to having no spatial parts. But there's this further idea that there's no metaphysical plurality or fragmentation in God at all. God is really, in a very robust sense, one, so that there is no distinction between God and God's attributes, between one attribute and another. So what's so bad about being metaphysically plural? Part of it is this Greek philosophy that was taken over very, very early on. Right? It's not a late importation, that sees what is one and what is unified as just sort of obviously superior to what is fragmented and multiple. And but beyond those intuitions, there's a very clear argument from God's aseity. So from the fact that God is utterly independent of everything that is not God. And that is, if God is distinct from any of his attributes, then God can't be who or what he is apart from something that is distinct from God himself. And so if God is not God's justice, then God depends on God's justice to be God. And so God depends on something other than himself to be who or what he is, in violation of this idea of classical theism, and which is a very intuitively powerful idea, that in order to be absolutely perfect, God is utterly independent of everything else. Everything else depends on him. He depends on nothing. In order for that to work, then, the tradition has argued repeatedly and emphatically that God must be utterly without parts of any kind, spatial, temporal, or metaphysical. And you see this very clearly in somebody like Augustine, you see it in Anselm, you see it in Aquinas. But simplicity causes some problems. One of the most obvious problems is that we've typically believed that God could have not created. We certainly have typically believed that the creatures that God created are free, and that if creatures are free, that means that they could at least sometimes do otherwise than they actually do. We also believe that God knows absolutely everything, right? It's part of the divine nature. It turns out on simplicity, it is the divine nature that God knows absolutely everything. Well, but how is that going to work on divine simplicity? because God's knowledge is just God. But if what God knows could turn out differently, given that God could have not created or that his creatures could have acted otherwise, then God's knowledge could be different. But if God's knowledge could be different, then God could be different. But God's supposed to be a necessary being, not a contingent being. And so it's hard to see how you can get that on simplicity. Maybe not by itself a devastating argument against simplicity, but it gives you a sort of a taste for why people worry about it. So along comes SCOTUS. SCOTUS affirms simplicity. The argument of that paper, though, and I do think this is right, is that he kind of affirms it verbally. But he chips away at it in ways that Anselm and company would view it as that's not simplicity. You're calling it simplicity, but that's not what simplicity is. You're going to have austerity worries. You're going to have other worries. So what's the distinction? What's the distinction between, say, God and God's knowledge, or God and God's justice? Well, it's not what the medievals called a real distinction, SCOTUS says, because a real distinction for them is when two items are inseparable, separable, at least by divine power. So when two things are really distinct, they can exist apart from each other, at least by divine power. So a classic medieval example, which I could probably, from our confessional backgrounds, none of the three of us would particularly warm to, is transubstantiation in the Eucharist. So that at least by divine power, a substance can exist apart from its accidents and vice versa. You don't ordinarily get the accidents of bread and wine existing apart from the substance. But in this case, it's possible. So we can say they're really distinct, right? That's our evidence or our clue that they're really distinct. We can't have that, obviously, between God and his wisdom, because that would be saying that, yeah, God and God could exist without being wise. At least it would be within God's power to make himself exist without being wise. That's clearly crazy. No real distinction. Simplicity says, yeah, so that's why the only distinction is a conceptual distinction, right? Because of the way our minds work and because of the way we gather our concepts bit by bit and piecemeal, we can think of God without thinking of his wisdom and vice versa. We can think of God as separate from his wisdom. Our language kind of encourages us to do that because we think in these subject predicate ways, right? God is wise, like Thomas Williams is bald. Right? In my case, the baldness is not me. I used to have hair. Sounds like the same thing with God. God is wise. Okay. No, that's a function of our language and our conceptualization. There's only a conceptual distinction. SCOTUS says there's got to be more than a conceptual distinction, in part because God's attributes, it's different attributes to make a classical theist wince. God's different attributes play different roles in the economy of salvation. And all of y'all have been saying these things all along. My SCOTUS is apparently that Southern. I am from Memphis, by the way. That's not an affectation. I realize my accent is all off, but I'm entitled to y'all. All of y'all have been saying these things. So, you know, go back to Anselm. Well, God does this through his mercy. He does that through his justice. Well, you're not allowed to say that if there's no distinction at all between God's mercy and God's justice, right? Similarly, with other possible distinctions, SCOTUS thinks the same thing, that God's justice and God's mercy play different roles in the economy of salvation. Well, so there's got to be a distinction, something more than conceptual but less than real. Okay, I'm going to call that the formal distinction. And what is the formal distinction? Well, it's a distinction between two things that are inseparable, but the distinction is not mind-made, right, as a conceptual distinction is. So there is really in God a distinction between, say, justice and mercy, but it's not a real distinction. That's where SCOTUS sounds like he's just kind of making stuff up. But you can see terminologically how it works out. It's not a function of the way our language works or the way our mind works only, that we speak of divine mercy and divine justice separately. There's something in God that grounds divine mercy and grounds what we say about divine mercy and divine justice separately. It's just that they are inseparable from each other in God and united with each other in God. Is that enough to get us started on at least what the formal decision
is? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Because I do think there has been a desire among some who find the strict identity type claims of Thomas Aquinas when it comes to simplicity hard to swallow. So it seems people are wanting to say, I want to have a version of simplicity, but can I tone it down a little bit? And it seems SCOTUS is a option, at least in the historical witness, who's trying to do that. Yeah. So what's the objections to this version and the formal distinction?
This is where I really wish my co-author were here instead of me. A lot of people just think it doesn't make sense, right? That the distinctions are either sort of there in the world or they're only in the mind. And this idea that you can have a distinction where things are inseparable in reality, but also distinct enough that the mind is tracking rather than creating the distinction is a sort of false idea. The fact is that SCOTUS puts it to use in lots of places in his metaphysics. And I don't find any great difficulty in the idea. I say that to bring up the idea that it's not an ad hoc move. The way, for example, a generation later, Occam will say, there are no real relational entities. That's what the best philosophy teaches us. Oh, but we got to put them back in to get the Trinity. I mean, philosophy would tell you not to have them. It's not an ad hoc move like that to save your theological doctrine. He uses it everywhere. He uses it to talk about the distinction between the soul and its powers. So what's the distinction between my soul and my intellect? Well, my intellect and my soul are inseparable. My intellect and my will are inseparable. So clearly, and that seems clearly right, but they're both rooted in me. I can't have a soul without either of them. Both of them are united inextricably in my intellect. That's just what the formal distinction is. So it becomes really useful in talking about us. It becomes really useful also in talking about God. So my puzzle earlier about how can God's knowledge perhaps have been different? Maybe, though I don't have the metaphysical chops to work this out myself, maybe the formal distinction will allow us a way to say that, because there is a formal distinction between God's nature and God's knowledge. And so it might be that you can save the necessity of God's nature while acknowledging the contingency of at least some aspect of God's knowledge. Certainly where SCOTUS would want to go with that.
Maybe we can zoom out a little bit. We've been talking about a few specific issues here and just have you orient SCOTUS within, you know, the broader medieval stream of thinking. Was he, during his day, was he well-respected and was he read a lot? And maybe those centuries immediately following his life and his writing, how much impact did he have on the thoughts of those that came? And maybe if you feel comfortable answering this, how much impact did he have on the thoughts of the reformers since they were, you know, coming along not too long after his thought?
So backing up a little bit from SCOTUS's day, so he's writing in the 1290s and the first decade of the 14th century. There's this, I don't want to exaggerate it as people have, but this somewhat pivotal event called the Condemnation of 1277. People talk a lot about this. What happened was that the Bishop of Paris issued a very disorderly and jumbled list of a whole bunch of stuff that he had heard that faculty at the University of Paris were teaching, that they had to stop teaching because they were regarded as too Aristotelian. So the Aristotle's works had been absorbed, lectured on, received, and so forth. There had been attempts to kind of they'd been a lot of them had been lost to the Latin West for a long time. When they came back in, they came in first through the arts faculty, which would be basically like our general education kind of faculty, because they were the people who were going to be teaching philosophy. And they were all excited about Aristotle, and some of them may have got carried away with being a little too Aristotelian and not kind of disciplined enough in Christianity. At least the bishop thought as much. And so he issues this list of condemned propositions, some of which had clearly been taught by Thomas Aquinas, even though this was a condemnation of what they were saying in the arts faculty, and Aquinas had been in the theology faculty. It's very clear that he was a target of this condemnation. A lot of those condemned theses were along two lines. One, views that seemed to kind of deny or limit or truncate the scope of God's power. So there was a very heavy emphasis on a pretty freewheeling view of what divine omnipotence meant. And the other was a condemnation of various theses that were intellectualist, right, as opposed to voluntarist. At least some people argue that Aquinas himself was an intellectualist in his psychology and about certain topics about God. So in the aftermath of the condemnation, it's not as if medieval philosophers and theologians were any better behaved than contemporary ones, right? Even if your bishop tells you, you got to stop teaching this, you keep teaching it anyway. And you just say, well, you've sort of misunderstood what I meant. But there was definitely an impetus to a pretty freewheeling view of divine omnipotence and a stronger and more, I guess, maybe elaborate, maybe intense sort of voluntarism being taught. Scotus is coming along, so 1277, he's teaching in the 1290s, in the kind of heyday of Franciscans going all out about divine omnipotence and being voluntarist and so forth, fighting against the Dominicans largely, who were in many cases maintaining Aquinas' theses, saying, well, the condemnations are based on misapprehensions, or this is not really what Aquinas meant, and all of you Franciscans are misrepresenting him. There are battles back and forth about, you know, if you're a Franciscan, you're not even supposed to read Aquinas unless you read him with our list of Franciscan gripes. I mean, this was actually a decision that was made. So in that kind of atmosphere, Scotus was a very attractive figure. And since he was clearly an incredibly subtle and powerful thinker, known, of course, as the subtle doctor, and described as subtle even within his own lifetime, he had a very powerful influence. Part of that influence was William of Ockham reading him and finding lots of problems with him. But he nonetheless had enormous respect for Scotus. For long stretches of medieval philosophy, there were more Scotists in some places and at some times, by far more Scotists than there were Thomists or Ockhamists or Albertists. Nobody talks about Albertists. So he was tremendously influential. There are a lot of commentators around Scotus, people who developed Scotus's views. There's a whole sort of Scotist tradition, a lot of which has not been explored adequately, including, I must say, by me. And there's a lot of work that would have to be done by scholars. None of that stuff is in English, or almost none of that stuff is in English, apart from Ockham, of course, who has been pretty well translated. There's a forthcoming volume of Ockham's Ethics from Cambridge University Press that will, I think, go nicely. It's by Eric Hagedorn, who did a great job with it. It will go nicely with my volume on Scotus's Ethics from Oxford University Press. So, you know, more stuff is becoming available. So Scotus was tremendously influential. It's harder for me to say what sort of impact he had on the reformers because a lot of the literature about the impact on the reformers of Scotus or Ockham or other later figures to me suffers from these blanket ideas about how, you know, for example, Scotus and Ockham were nominalists, and nominalism is a really bad thing. And well, in a lot of contemporary theological discourse, nominalism turns out just to mean stuff I don't like theologically. Scotus, in fact, was not a nominalist, and he's very explicitly a realist about universals. Ockham was a nominalist, but so why does this view about whether or not there are real natures, right, real essences, how does that get you to rejecting the authority of the Pope or teaching sola scriptura or sola fide? That's that's not a case I've seen made very well. And since my, as it were, my theological and spiritual life as a part of a church that I won't say had its origin in the Reformation because I'm Anglo-Catholic, but was certainly greatly transformed and for the better by the Reformation, is sort of separate from my scholarly life as a pre-Reformation guy. So the one part of me sort of kind of tapers off in the middle of the 14th century. I probably need to bring those two things together more effectively than I have.
I think you've hinted at it a little bit throughout this and just some of the areas that need work, need research, need study. And I think, at least in my neck of the woods, a lot of Protestants are interested in this broad retrieval or resourcement from this medieval period and finding good conversation partners, finding good resources to engage and, I guess, expand the broadly lowercase c Catholic church. And so I guess this question is a little bit two-part. Number one, where are the most accessible and affordable places to find the works of Scotus that are in English? And then number two, what are the areas of his thinking in particular that you think probably deserve the most research now? And is there anyone else in this period that really needs to be retrieved that has just kind of been completely ignored?
Let me answer that second question first. And then if I forget the first question, you can remind me of it. I've thought a little bit about sources, and though here's someone who has not been ignored, who's actually been talked about a lot, but I think is almost never actually read. And that's Anselm. I think you've had, or you will have an episode of Anselm, but I would encourage people, you know, before you read what anybody else says about Anselm, including me. I mean, do go ahead and read my stuff on Anselm if you want to, but Anselm himself is one of the most lucid, accessible writers in the tradition. And he's been, I can't say well translated because I'm about to recommend my own translation, but he's been very accessibly and cheaply translated. So if you go to Hackett, there's a volume of Anselm's basic writings, which is my translation. It's got all the essentials. It's about 450 pages. You can go to my website, profthomaswilliams.com, and I translate all the rest of the treatises, plus some prayers and meditations and even some letters. And it amounts to about 600 print pages. And that's everything, right? Except for some of the prayers and a chunk of the letters. That is the best way of encountering this brilliant mind, because he just didn't write that much, and he wrote so lucidly. So that would be the first place I would go. Now, so Scotus. The volume I did for Oxford on Scotus's ethics is pretty recent, and it's been well reviewed and well received, and that's a good place. If you're more interested in properly theological topics. So, I mean, there's some theological virtue stuff in there. There's some stuff about divine charity and so forth. There are theological topics, and of course, theological voluntarism comes up or not, depending on whether I'm reading those things properly or not. Right? But if you're interested in stuff like, you know, what's the nature of God? How does he understand the Trinity? How does he understand the incarnation, the atonement? Atonement's a particular obsession of mine, both as a scholar and just as a believer. Then you don't have good sources for that, unfortunately. So there are bits and pieces. There's an old volume. It's a little bit out of date now because of the progress in the editions that's available from Hackett by Alan Walter, and so that can still be used. He also has some of the questions on Mary, including Scotus' defense of the Immaculate Conception. So those tend to be an out of the way places, but if you go to Franciscan Institute publications, you can find those things. So I probably just do need to get to work so that these things will be more available in English. Occam has been better served by translators than Scotus. There's a lot of good 13th, 14th, 15th century stuff that people are just not paying as much attention to as they should, including authors that I skip over myself because there's only so much time.
And for the listeners, Dr. Williams just mentioned it, but his website is profthomaswilliams.com, and he has, you know, papers on there that you can go check out. So I do encourage everybody to check all that out. But Dr. Williams, I wanted to give you a second, if you would like to, if you have any. We started to talk about this before we were recording. Any publications that you have coming up that you think the listeners might be interested in knowing about? I don't know what you can talk about and can't talk about as far as, you know, book contracts and all that stuff. So if you have anything that you think we'd be interested in, let us know.
Thanks for that question. I've got an essay on atonement in the forthcoming new edition of the Cambridge Companion to Thomas Aquinas, which I'm really excited about being a part of. There are almost no Protestants in that volume. And I think I may be sort of just Catholic enough to have gotten by with it. But in any event, I'm really pleased that I get to talk about how Aquinas understands the saving work of Christ, because as I say, that is a particular favorite of mine. The very short introduction series from Oxford University Press has agreed to do a book on Anselm. I talked them into that, and I'm really excited about that. So that's my project for the summer, and I will have it to the press by September 1st, and I hope then out sometime in 2022. And then the project after that is kind of returning to my roots, which is writing a book on Scotus's ethics. That's also under contract with Oxford. That will take a little bit more time, probably a year, year and a half from now, in which I talk about kind of all my old stuff again from the 90s, which I can defend against criticisms that have come up in the 20 years or so since. And also a bunch of stuff I don't talk about in my earlier work, like virtue and how practical reasoning works for Scotus, and basically just any kind of ethical, anything that would belong to ethics is going to be in there. I'm really excited about finally doing that. It's only been in the last few years that we've had good Latin editions of, well, sorry, I won't go off on that rant. That we've had good Latin editions, usable Latin editions of Scotus's work on ethics, and that had, so it's high time that somebody do that work, and so I'm going to do that work.
That's awesome, man. This has been really fun. Do you have anything besides your website? Do you have a Twitter or anything that people can follow you on?
I do have a Twitter. I don't think I understand how to use Twitter just yet. I got on it just because a friend of mine was on it, and it's sort of bewildering, but if people want to give it a try, my handle is THOSWilliams67. So capital T, capital W, and 67 is my birth year. So THOSWilliams67. And maybe I'll figure out how to use it.
Well, this has been really, really fun. So I imagine people are going to ask, when are you going to have Dr. Williams back on the show? So hopefully you enjoyed it as much as we did.
I've had a great time. Yeah, thank you so much.
We'll have to come up with another topic that we badger you with. So this has been a lot of fun. I encourage everybody to check out his website where a lot of the resources are, as well as be on the lookout for these books that will be coming out in due course. We'll make sure to alert you when those come out so that you can get a copy of them for yourself, because I know most of our listeners are book junkies and they'd like to get new books about pretty much everything. And I do got to give a shout out to him. My son's here, like putting a shirt over his head, like, and Dr. Williams has kept a straight face this entire time and stayed focused. So
I think he's been extraordinarily well behaved. You have to be really proud.
Well, thanks. And thanks again for everybody who's been listening. This is the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet, and we thank you for tuning in.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.